My full name is Bhairavan Viswanathan. I've been in internal medicine solo practice in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania since 1986. At this time, I'm semi-retired and I still work frequently for other doctors' offices whenever they take vacation. So I'm maintaining my license and other particulars, and I intend to do this all of next year and the year after. I see only general internal medicine patients and of all varieties, no children in my practice. And because I'm in internal medicine, which is a general type of practice, I see diseases of various kinds, and I would say that aside from diabetes and coronary artery disease, I have seen and continue to see cancer patients, and we all have to keep up to date with cancer prevention strategies as well as cancer referral strategies. Most of us in internal medicine do not treat cancer because that's a highly specialized branch of medicine, and they are always referred to an oncologist. And so this is what I do, and I'm very happy to be part of this discussion. Now Dr. Gopi can tell us about himself.
Yeah, my name is Gopinath. I go by Gopi all the time. And I'm not a medical doctor. I am a professor here at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. Uh-huh. And I know the director of the Guitar Cancer Hospital and Research Center, Dr. Ravi Kannan, and he's from Chennai, and he's been at Guitar for the past 3 years, and his primary motivation is to help the 7 northeastern states have a comprehensive cancer care center, and I don't know if you're familiar with the northeastern region, there's only one cancer hospital for those 7 states, people have a lot of difficulty commuting from one state to another in the Northeast, and so many people don't even get any basic care with respect to cancer, and cancer incidence is also very high in that region because of tobacco, tea, and other plantation crops which require a lot of nitrogen fertilizer, and so if you apply a lot of nitrogen, you are exposed to more of this chemical stuff. And as a result, Assam got the highest cancer incidence in the country. And this hospital is a very small hospital. It's a 50-bedded center. It's located in Silchar, which is in the southern part of Assam. It's not near Guwahati. And you can fly from Kolkata to Silchar as a daily flight. You can fly in. And essentially, they serve Manipur, Mizoram, Tripura, and the southern Assam part, and they see about 4,000 new patients every year, and returning patients, if you add that up, it'll be about 10,000 patients annually. And 80% of the people that show up at the hospital are making 2,000 rupees or 1,500 rupees a month as salary. They just cannot afford to do any kind of treatment, and many of them wait until the advanced stage to show up that actually requires a surgery. A surgery sometimes costs in the neighborhood of 25,000, 30,000 rupees. And the people who don't have any land or any house have no choice but to just refuse surgery because they don't have any money and go back home. The other ones, those that have a little bit of assets, resources, if they have a quarter of an acre of land, they basically have to sell it to get the 25,000 rupees to pay for the surgery. But that 25,000 that they could get from the land could go to either a daughter's wedding or a son's future or, you know, the father or mother's health. And so they face really, you know, difficult choices. And the hospital provides free care to really poor people and only charges very minimal fee even for other patients. And I've been there 3 times. It just breaks your heart to see people just don't have basic cancer care in the northeastern region of the country. And so we decided to help the Guitar Cancer Hospital, and I work with the Assam Foundation here in New Jersey, Mr. Nomal Datta, and he and Dr. Sanjeev Bhuyan, both of them helped me to hold the Guitar Cancer Hospital under the Assam Foundation as a non-profit in the U.S. So we can raise funds legally, which includes a tax break that you can get in the U.S., and then send the money back to India. So that's kind of an overview of what about the hospital as well as what you're trying to do.
Okay. Before I launch on what I have prepared to talk on this line, I would like to let everybody know that if there are any questions at the end of my presentation, please be, I'll be very happy to answer them the best way I can. Since the situation with regard to cancer in the United States is somewhat different from that of India, in the sense we are not having any areas in this country that are, at least at this point in time, declared as being highly risky for cancer. We have just cancer as an occurring and reoccurring phenomenon in different people who have cancer risk based on their lifestyle or based on their genetic makeup or their family history more than anything else. They are not used to any kind of pollution that causes the problem, although many people with cancer nowadays of the lung are showing up because they have been exposed to asbestos or they have been exposed to other carcinogens when they were younger, and now they are turning into cancer patients off and on, and of course smoking is playing an extremely important role. The other thing I need to know at the end of my talk is how much is the role can be played by preventing an early detection of cancer in this particular part of India, because that is the thing that we are trying to emphasize as much as possible, because we can't completely eliminate cancer anywhere in the world. But what we can do is we can do early detection, and then we'll be able to cure cancer by treatment early on. And if it's allowed to grow, it's impossible, yeah?
I can definitely answer your questions on that.
What I wanted to say, what I was given to understand was to speak in terms of various cancers that that at this point in time either have established preventive routines and early detection routines, and those that we are working on early prevention routines, because I think in a country like India, prevention is definitely more important than getting to treatment. You just mentioned how expensive it is to get the treatment. And the most important thing I notice in a general view is that because this is brought on by likely a large role being played by the environment and the presence of fertilizer factories, it is something that individual levels, people cannot take necessary precautions to avoid getting cancer. And of course, early detection probably will be more important than advice to persons on how to avoid cancer. Of course, everybody should quit smoking, whether it's bidis or cigarettes or cigars or anything like that, because that definitely makes for much higher incidence of cancer, not only in the lung, but in other parts of the body, such as the GI tract, we know that now, and also of the urinary bladder. Now, in the United States, one of the most common cancers is the colon cancer, and we have learned a lot about it so far, and we have put into effect a lot of precautionary methods over the last 20 years. Initially, we used to just test randomly stool for blood, and if any blood was found, then we would do a endoscopic examination to detect cancer early. And now, of course, we are recommending and we are carrying out as much as possible routine colonoscopies in everybody over the age of 50, men and women. Everybody at 50 should get a colonoscopy, whether they have any symptoms or they don't have any symptoms. It is much more effective that way than looking for blood in the stool, which can be missed. And if this is a negative examination, then they don't have to get another colonoscopy for anywhere from 5 to 7 years. But if they do have anything that looks like a polyp, which is benign, of course it should be removed so that it becomes, does not become cancerous. And then subsequent to that, they need another colonoscopy within 3 years, and follow that by either 3 yearly or 5 yearly until they are completely free of any reoccurrence. So that's what we have by way of early detection and cutting down the number of colon cancers every year in the United States. The next one, which is a very fearsome cancer, is breast cancer. It seems to be more prevalent in women who have either a family history or who have never born children, or if they have born children, they have not breastfed their children. It is more frequent in these people, and therefore they have to be forewarned that they are at a higher risk because of these reasons. So what we do for this is we take all women over the age of 40, regardless of whether there's a family history or they don't have a family history, and we make them go through a screening mammogram. Now, at the age of 40, it is done once. Subsequent to that, it is done, if it's negative, every 2 years. And after the age of 50, it is done every year, because as a woman gets older, her chance of getting breast cancer is higher and higher. And if there's anything that looks abnormal on a screening mammogram, we further go and do what's called a diagnostic mammogram, which is a more accurate test, and even an MRI of the breast if necessary, to make sure that we are able to see a small cancer which can be immediately removed. And that's what we are following by way of reducing the number of breast cancers. And if there are people who have got a occurrence of very early breast cancer, like 30 years or younger breast cancer women, then they have to be checked genetically for the presence of an abnormal chromosome or gene, which is called the BRAC1 and BRAC2, BRAC1 and BRAC2. And if they happen to have this, that means they are at very high risk for developing breast cancer on the other side, and they have to be treated as if they have breast cancer on both sides, and they have to be treated accordingly, which might even go on to having a mastectomy on both sides, so that they don't have another breast cancer come on and then kill them. And also, every member of their family should be tested for the BRAC gene. So these things are also done as exceptional cases of young age cancer in women. Now we come to cervical cancer, which we have been dealing with for many, many years now, and it's been a long, long time since we have put into place what's called a pap smear, which is a vaginal examination followed by taking samples of cells from the cervix of the uterus and looking for abnormal cells, cancer cells. Now, this has been recommended for those over the age of 50 in the old days, but now, for the past 10 or 15 years, it's been recommended for anybody who is sexually active, no matter what their age may be, as long as they are at least 20, 25 years of age onwards. If they are sexually active, either due to marriage or due to having multiple partners, they definitely must have a pap smear done every year, because this is something that cannot be neglected. Early detection is the best way to detect this cancer and treat it with a hysterectomy. They also have found in the last 5 years that the occurrence of a papilloma virus infection of the cervix, which is transmitted sexually, is the beginning a factor for inducing of cervical cancer. So those who have got multiple sexual partners or who have got an infection of the HPV or the human papilloma virus are at very high risk for getting cervical cancer. And therefore, these people should be treated for the presence of that virus, because if you do a pap test and it comes back positive for the virus, then they definitely need to be treated for the virus so that that doesn't induce the cancer. And also, on top of that, in the last few years, we have now started to give all young women over the age of 4 or 5 years of age until the age of 26 a single injection of a vaccine, which does prevent you from getting HPV infection. So you prevent the infection, then you are not likely to get the cancer. So these are the steps we have taken for the cervical cancer detection and treatment. I was talking about lung cancer, and it is still one of the most prevalent cancers in the United States, because during the 50s, 60s, and even 70s, cigarette smoking was extremely common and very popular, and people who used to smoke heavily, and many of them were doing that in the country, have already induced cancer in their lungs. And even though they did not find cancer in those years, now they are turning up with cancer. Almost 90% of those who show up with cancer in the United States in the lungs have a history of smoking, even if they have quit smoking 20 years ago. Even if they have quit smoking, they have it. So anybody who is a smoker and comes up with even a mild symptom to do with the lung, like coughing or slight weight loss, no, we are very particular about checking the lungs out. X-rays do not detect anything, you know, significant. We have to do a CAT scan, and if the CAT scan is negative, then we have to look at the sputum for cancer cells, and if that is negative, then we have to put the patient through surveillance. That is a periodic, like every year, CAT scans of the chest, because that's the only way to detect this early and then have the lung cancer treated. I believe in a place like India and other places where these CAT scans are not that easily available, just a simple X-ray of the chest would be better than not doing anything. That's the best way to see if we can detect this cancer early. Then we come to prostate cancer, a very common cancer in the United States. I don't know its prevalence in India and other parts of the world, but in the United States it's very, very common. Fortunately, about 50-60% of these prostate cancers are not very rapidly growing or aggressive. A person may have cancer of the prostate and may not even require treatment, just observation. But you never know who is going to develop into this aggressive, fatal type of prostate cancer. For that, for any kind of cancer detection of the prostate, we have put in place at least 20-25 years ago routines that we do on all patients. that would be to give them a rectal examination in which the prostate is felt and if it's abnormal, that is a sign that cancer is developing there, and also followed up with a blood test, which is done on all men over the age of 40-45 every year. It's called the prostate-specific antigen or PSA test, and it has to be done. It's a fairly accurate test because if it is clearly abnormal, it means prostate cancer is present, and they have to be subjected to other tests to detect the cancer size and location and start treatment. Usually, if the PSA is abnormal and positive, then we have to advise the patient that he has to undergo what's called a sonogram or a ultrasound of the prostate, which might detect the cancer. If that is negative, then he might even have to undergo transrectal prostate biopsy to make sure the cancer cells are not there already. And this way, we have been able to detect many men who are developing early cancer, and we have put them on treatment, and they have been cured. And it's possible to cure prostate cancer like this. Occasionally, a patient may have a very aggressive kind of a cancer, and even treatment may fail, but most of them do respond. Then we come, I'm only enumerating in my list cancers that I've got some method by which we can detect them early, know their cause, and also take prophylactic action. The next cancer will be liver cancer. Now, for a long time, we did not know anything about liver cancer. I think probably until approximately the early 80s, when hepatitis B became a very prevalent disease along with hepatitis C, and then only we started to relate these two viral infections to liver cancer. Before that, we thought it was just a spontaneous occurrence, and people got liver cancer for no known reason. Now we know that the good majority of patients who develop cancer of the liver either have an infection of the liver with hepatitis B virus or hepatitis C. Now, for hepatitis B, a person can get infected by sexual intercourse or by receiving contaminated blood transfusion or by injection received by a contaminated needle that is carrying the virus from another patient. And once the patient gets hepatitis B, it has to be, and if it's undetected or not treated, it goes underneath, it becomes what's called chronic hepatitis B. And when you have chronic hepatitis B, it sets up the cycle for eventually the patient developing hepatocellular or liver cancer, and it's a pretty aggressive cancer. The same story is true of hepatitis C. And unfortunately for hepatitis C, which is also sexually transmitted and transmitted through injections and blood transfusions, all we can do at this point in time is to keep an eye on them by doing periodic liver function tests, doing ultrasound of the liver, and even biopsies of the liver. But patients with chronic hepatitis C and chronic hepatitis B are those that really can get cancer of the liver, and they have to be forewarned. We subject to surveillance studies and also to subject themselves to treatment if it's detected. There's another one or two things that are related to liver cancer, and one is excessive alcoholism, and the third one is cirrhosis of the liver. If a person gets cirrhosis or fibrosis or scarring of the liver due to any reason, not necessarily hepatitis B or C, that will induce cancer in that liver. So we have to be very careful, the doctors, in keeping an eye on patients who have cirrhosis of the liver and detect the cancer early. The blood test that's available to confirm the presence of liver cancer is very useful once the patient is suspected of having cancer because of indirect test results on an ultrasonogram or the presence of abnormal liver function tests or a history of hepatitis C and B and weight loss. We have to start thinking in terms of the liver cancer. Anytime the doctor thinks that a person might have liver cancer, he must order this blood test, because this blood test is always negative unless the person has cancer of the liver. It's called alpha fetoprotein, and it's commonly available in the United States, and we order these tests on a fairly frequent basis on the right kind of patients. Another cancer that is now on the increase in the United States is esophageal cancer. We used to see this not very much in the 70s and 80s, and now since the mid-90s and going on through the 21st century, we are having problems with esophageal cancer. It seems to be occurring very frequently, or not very frequently, but I would say more commonly and more frequently in patients who have what's called regurgitation syndrome, where the acid runs up from the stomach onto the esophagus and burns the esophagus. These patients have symptoms of heartburn, they have symptoms of discomfort in the stomach and chest, and many times they are wrongly diagnosed as having heart attack because of chest pain, and they have these symptoms ignored, or they are treated by the patient himself with the use of antacids. And if a patient is susceptible to these symptoms and they're chronic and reoccurring, it might ultimately end up in giving him cancer of the esophagus. We don't know how to relate the high acidity and the burning of the lower end of the esophagus with the acid causing cancer, but it is definitely an association that we can't afford to ignore. And we are very careful about making sure that patients have got a long history of acid regurgitation are subjected to endoscopy. We don't do anything simpler than that. There's just no way to detect esophageal cancer with a barium swallow or some kind of an X-ray. There's nothing to do that. We have to literally look into the esophagus, because the surface of the esophagus is where the cancer starts, and it has to look abnormal. It has to be biopsied. So we have no problem in those who have good insurance to have upper endoscopy done of the esophagus and the lower end of the, and the upper end of the stomach. Anytime we suspect that they have had these regurgitation symptoms for 5 years or more. So that is one important thing we do here. Now, there is a condition that's called Barrett's esophagus, where the lower end of the esophagus, the epithelium lining that, begins to look abnormal. It's not quite cancerous yet, but it looks abnormal, and it might be in that abnormal state for years and years before it becomes cancerous. So anytime we detect somebody who has got this kind of an esophageal lining during the endoscopy, they are immediately told about the diagnosis, and that it is extremely important for these people to undergo an endoscopy every year for the rest of their life, because we never know when this Barrett's esophagus is going to turn into a cancerous esophagus. So those of people who have Barrett's esophagus on a diagnosis, it is the responsibility of the doctor to make sure that they get an endoscopy every year. Now we come to the next organ, which is the stomach. Cancer of the stomach is not very common in the Western countries. It's much more common in countries where the hygiene is not good on the things that they eat, because now we found out that there is a particular bacterium which sets up the stage for the cancer of the stomach. This is an infection that doesn't cause much discomfort, doesn't cause diarrhea, vomiting, or any such major symptoms. It simply gives indigestion symptoms. It sits in the stomach and keeps growing there, and it's impossible to get rid of unless it is detected. But somehow, this particular bacterium, which is called H. pylori, has a tendency to do two things. One, it increases the acid output of the stomach. And second thing it does, that it changes the epithelium or the lining of the stomach, and that becomes like Barrett's esophagus, it becomes cancerous. So if we have a patient who has got symptoms of what appears like peptic ulcer, we don't just say, okay, take some antacid and go home, forget about it. We don't do that very much. What we do is we make sure that this patient is getting a test to see if he has got H. pylori infection in the stomach. For that, we have blood tests, and we also have ways of looking at the gastric juice and other tests that we do with the carbon monoxide inhalation and detecting of changes in that in the exhaled breath. But when we do these things and we find the patient has this infection, it is mandatory for him to be treated with an antibiotic, because when you don't treat with the antibiotic, this condition will be chronic and will cause cancer of the stomach. Other people who can get cancer of the stomach are those who have a very strong family history, and we can't do anything about detecting them very early. If they do have a very strong family history, then we do subject them to periodic endoscopies, but we don't have any surveillance methodology in place at this time. We now come to the urinary system, that it's kidneys. Now, unfortunately, at this point in time, I'm going to say very little about it, because we have no way by which we can detect kidney cancer. Most of the time, we detect kidney cancer only by accident. We do a CAT scan on somebody's abdomen for some symptoms to do with some other organ in the abdomen, and it shows up a kidney showing a tumor. And that's the time that we detect that's a cancer, and we have to take the kidney out. But otherwise, what we do is, if somebody shows up with blood and urine and he's complaining of no pain, then we check the bladder. The example sample the urine and look for cancer cells, and then we don't just look at the bladder, we also look at the kidneys on both sides. And sometimes the bladder is normal and the blood is coming from one of the kidneys that has got a cancer. So it's kind of like an accidental discovery. Most of the time with kidney cancer, we have no way by which we can really run tests on people and detect these patients who are having early kidney cancer. They are working on methods by which they are going to be doing simple and inexpensive cytologies or cell examinations of the urine when anybody comes to the doctor's office and gets a urine test, which is tested for other things like diabetes. They can also get a check to see if they have kidney cancer. Now, bladder cancer is something that's not very common, and it is something that we have absolutely nothing we can do to detect that early, but some kinds of professions, people get more bladder cancer than others, but fortunately, I don't know about India and other countries where people are exposed to huge quantities of carcinogens, you know, in the place of work. But anything to do with the work with aniline dyes, and the dye industry is the one that used to use aniline to make dyes, but it's completely been outmoded and outlawed in the United States. We don't have that chemical in the dye plants anymore, but I believe in some parts of the world, aniline is still being used in dye production, and those who work closely with aniline dyes are at some risk of bladder cancer. And it is something that can occur spontaneously in people who are not exposed to anything, and we have no way of detecting that unless somebody shows up with blood in the urine, by which time the cancer has already spread quite a bit. Now, testicular cancer is something that is not very common. It is something that only young men get. You don't have to be in your 60s to get this disease. Usually men in their 30s get it or younger. And the one that is always or very frequently associated with testicular cancer is a condition called undescended testicle, where the testicle on one side does not come down into the scrotum and stays up in the groin. A testicle that is still sitting up there and has not come down after the child is born, that particular testicle is at very high risk for developing cancer, almost 95% risk of developing cancer. Therefore, you have patients who have one side undescended testicles, they have to undergo removal of the testicle, or they can have an operation done at which time they bring that testicle down into the scrotum in the normal position, and then you are free of the risk of testicular cancer. Otherwise, if we have patients who come into our offices and they're complaining of testicular discomfort, pain, swelling, then a proper examination is always done. And sometimes you can detect something like a tumor or a cancer in the testicle. If we don't let go at that point. As a preventive measure, we send the patient for ultrasonogram. And the sonogram of the scrotum clearly will tell us if there is a tumor in the testicle. And if it's present, then we don't stop there. We go one step further and do a biopsy. We should rule out the presence of either a benign or a cancerous tumor. Ovarian cancer is the woman's counterpart to the testicular cancer in men. Extremely dangerous cancer, and it's almost universally fatal. Even in the United States, we have got lots of chemotherapy for that, but we have a problem with early detection. And since we don't detect this cancer early, and we have no methodology to detect it early, most of the time we catch ovarian cancer when it's already spread, and at that point in time it is almost fatal. Now, we do have learned a few things in the last few years. One is that when we do pap tests on women and we do an internal examination, we feel for the ovaries. And if the ovary on one side is enlarged, then it's a kind of a flag that tells us to check into that with an ultrasonogram. If a patient complains of some very bizarre abdominal symptoms in the lower part of the pelvis, then that is again a reason to do a sonogram to see if the ovaries are normal size or are they enlarged, or is one of them having a tumor in it. And if anything like this is detected on a sonogram or on a pelvic examination with a feeling of the ovary showing that it's enlarged, you must do a test called the CA125. This is a specific antigen that is detected in patients who are having ovarian cancer. If CA125 is absent and the patient's ovary is enlarged, then very likely the enlargement is not due to the cancer. And if somebody's ovary is only slightly enlarged and you can hardly feel it, and the sonogram is equivocal, does not show yes or no answer, but then the CA125 is positive, then the patient does have covariant cancer. And we have to check which side it is, and we have to take precautions in treatment, and which is usually done. Rarely are we able to pick up ovarian cancers early and treat them and cure them. Now we come to the second last cancer that I have listed here, and that is skin cancer. Skin cancer is on the increase all over the world. It's probably because of the loss of ozone layer, and the ultraviolet rays coming down are much too strong, and they do induce cancer. It doesn't matter where you live in the world. And even temperate countries like Europe are getting serious problems with this disease. Induction of cancer is mostly due to sunlight, harmful effects of sunlight, and usually on the exposed part. So what we do here as the early detection method and as a prophylactic method is complete and thorough physical examination. We do that of the entire skin, right from the scalp down to the toes and in between the toenails, and in the back and front of the trunk, everywhere. And we also examine a patient who complains of anything that he thinks is wrong with his skin. If a patient complains, I think I've seen some kind of a lesion on my skin, we let him come into the office, and then we look at it ourselves. And if they are not sure, we get a biopsy. So the earlier we detect the presence of skin cancer, the quicker we can cure it. And in the United States, we have a system where anything that looks like a cancer is usually excised. It's not biopsied. It is simply taken out, and then it is subjected to microscopic examination. And 7 or 8 times out of 10, it shows early cancer. So that way, we have cured it. There is one cancer which is called melanoma, which is a very deadly cancer, always fatal. We are not able to get a handle on this very well early on, because this detection depends almost entirely on the patient. It's a patient who has come and say that I've got a lesion that looks dark in color and does not look like a normal part of my skin. If he doesn't see that, she doesn't see that, it'll grow. And what we do as doctors is to help the patient out is whenever we do a physical examination on the patient once a year or so, we make sure that we look specially for melanoma. Anything that looks pigmented and dark in color is assumed to be a melanoma unless it has got certain characters that indicate that it is benign. And we have any doubts, we don't let it go. We make sure that it is biopsy or it is excised. The final cancer I have to talk about is pancreas. It's an extremely dangerous cancer and definitely always fatal. We don't know what causes pancreatic cancer. There is no associated lifestyle points that indicate that a person is going to get cancer, and it's entirely a matter of clinical suspicion. These people who have pancreatic cancer usually have one symptom, and that is abdominal pain. But as you all know, there are many diseases that call abdominal pain. We can't start thinking of pancreatic cancer as the first thing. But the level of suspicion should be there, depending on the patient's age, usually in their 60s, the presence or absence of alcohol intake to excess, and having had a history of pancreatic inflammation or what's called pancreatitis. If they have any of these associated histories, then we have to think more about the possibility of pancreatic cancer. And it is also a cancer that is not infrequently associated with jaundice. The cause of jaundice is more frequently due to hepatitis or due to gallbladder disease or due to gallstones and other things, but it can be due to pancreatic cancer, because pancreatic cancer can choke the outflow of bile from the gallbladder and make you jaundiced. So patients who come in with any kind of a jaundice, we are making quite sure that they get a proper abdominal imaging study of CT or MRI to make sure that the pancreas is okay. If there's any suspicion that the pancreas is enlarged or the pancreas is likely to be the cause of the problem, we do an important blood test. It's called the CA19-9. It's also a cancer-related antigen that is detected in the bloodstream and is almost always positive in those with pancreatic cancer. There's no pancreatic cancer where the CA19-9 is negative. It has to be positive, just like CA125 for the ovarian cancer. So we do this also, but doing these things and suspecting it may be there sometimes gives a good handle, and there are occasional patients with pancreatic cancer who are diagnosed with the cancer just developing or just beginning to grow, and they can be cured with radical surgery and radiation therapy. So this is all the cancers that I know of and that I have seen, and I have also learned through my colleagues that are in some way susceptible to early detection cure. And this is all I have to say. I think I've gone over my time. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine, Uncle.
This is very interesting. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any question, anything that wasn't made clear by me that I can answer quickly?
I have one question. So did you say colon cancer is the most common cancer in the United States?
No, it's the lung cancer that's the most. As a matter of fact, let me see now. Yes, lung cancer is the most common now. Yes.
Lung cancer.
Lung. And then comes colon cancer.
I have a question. Sorry, go ahead.
The colon cancer thing is going to go down in course of time, because the people who have been exposed to smoking cigarettes and cigars, and who have had to live in very extremely polluted, non-EPA regulated industries, are all dying off. And the younger people who are going to be coming up in the next 10 years or so are going to be not having this disease, especially because of restriction in smoking. It's going to go down.
Yeah.
So it is still the most common cancer. Second most common cancer is the colon cancer, and then comes the breast. Anything else?
Yeah, I have a question on the liver cancer that you talked about.
Yes.
You said Hep B and Hep C infections can lead to a cancer?
Yes.
And even after they've been cured?
Oh, yes. It doesn't matter. Actually speaking, those that are cured, depending on how long they had the disease before they were treated and cured, sets them up for cancer of the liver, even though that it has been cured. And those who have not been treated for 5 years or more are definitely at a high risk. And those who will never get treatment are at the highest risk.
So regardless of whether you're treated or not, this is a risk.
Yes. The earlier the treatment is given, the less the chance of cancer.
I see.
The recommendation by the American Cancer Society is those who have had a diagnosis of hepatitis C and who have had it for a year or more, and they have been detected and they have been treated, they should be kept under surveillance for the possibility of the development.
Hep C as well.
C and both. B. Both.
B and C both, right?
B and C, yes.
Okay.
You don't have a problem with A and E.
Okay. That's news to me. I never knew that those two led to this kind of a problem. So.
Yeah, that is a problem. Indeed, in the United States and everywhere in the world, that is a very high problem. We don't know in India and other countries where people have been affected or have been infected with hepatitis B who have not had any treatment, what the occurrence of liver cancer is in those people as compared to the general population. We don't have all that data.
Yeah,
I don't even know if it has it.
Yeah.
But here we have some the reliable data. Here, as well as in Europe, they found that the hepatitis B and C are what we call precursors of liver cancer.
Interesting news. Yes. Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. This is very educational, and I hope the recording can be posted on the website, and we can educate myself on this.
I definitely want to make one final additional comment, and that is, I really, really wish that, as you mentioned, in Kachar and other places in the northeastern part of India, where industry is going completely out of control, you know, there has to be something that only the government can do. They are the only ones who can really regulate these things, because basically the population is going to be exposed to toxins like this in the air or in the water or in the soil.
Yeah.
You know, all these things I talked about is just useless, because, you know, it's like they have to do something about it. But we can still do something like at least early detection. You know, we have a person who has got likelihood of, because as you mentioned, skin cancer or lung cancer in that area, then we can do more probably by simply keeping our eyes open to that and then detecting it early.
Yeah.
if at all possible.
Yeah, I think Northeast is not just a production problem. Tobacco is also grown there, and then a significant amount of tobacco is consumed in the form of chewing tobacco.
Oh, yes, yes.
And so it causes ENT type cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
I think that's one of the largest in India.
I remember some years ago there was a particular ingredient that they were using, a particular brand name ingredient on what we call suparis, you know, and other kinds of things to freshen the mouth after you eat dinner, and that they were highly carcinogenic, and they have been taken off the market. Even children, you know, who were eating that were getting mouth cancer.
I don't think people in the Northeast are sophisticated in terms of pond, but I think they just directly consume tobacco, chewing tobacco, which is
very bad.
Dried and cured, I believe.
Yes.
And they just pull the chip of tobacco under their teeth, one side of the teeth.
Yes.
And keep chewing whenever they need to chew. And so maybe because they need this to work, they don't have enough food, they don't have nutrition, something's got to keep them going. And as a result, I think many of these people get addicted to tobacco.
I know. This is not probably nothing to do with India, but in another developing country in South America, Peru, it's been a natural thing for people there to choose coca leaves. Coca is what you make cocaine out of, and it definitely has got a salutary effect on giving you energy. Without chewing the coca leaves, the natives there cannot climb up and down those heavy mountains 10,000 feet above the earth. And they notice that when they do that, fortunately, that doesn't give any cancer anywhere. It's not even addicting. It is somehow or other very benign, locally available counterpart to fatigue that can affect anybody. If these natives don't eat the coca leaf, they can't do anything there. The air is too thin over there, but they're able to manage. It's definitely better than taking tobacco, but what can we do? This is what we have in India.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for this educational exercise. This is very nice. This is good.
You're welcome. Thank you. And Anil Bhai?
Anil,
have any other questions, just write me an email.
Sure.
About this subject. Okay?
Sure, I will. Thank you, Uncle.
Oh, thank you. I'll talk to you later, okay?
Sure.
Good luck. Good luck, Mr. Gopi. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.